Porter QI presents Quality for the Rest of Us with Gail Porter, investigating the mysterious world of healthcare in search of adventurous innovation and exciting solutions from professionals across the nation. Before we get into the episode, I have some exciting news to share. When I first started out in healthcare quality, I found that even with a certification, I felt like I was having to go to my boss over and over again with questions. How do I do this? Where do I find that? I wished that there was a place I could go where I could find a friendly guide to my job. So now, with over a decade of experience in healthcare quality improvement, working with more than 100 facilities to improve their processes and patient outcomes, I am sharing that experience with you in a new book called Quality for the Rest of Us, A Friendly Guide to Healthcare Quality Management. Whether you're just starting out or if you've been in the field for years, you can find something that will help you in your quality career in this book. I share all kinds of free resources, explain how to manage different types of data, describe the quality cycle in plain language, and even give tips on how to successfully complete a federal abstraction audit. And best of all, I use practical stories and a conversational tone to teach the basics of healthcare quality management in a way that's approachable for anyone. You can find Quality for the Rest of Us, A Friendly Guide to Healthcare Quality Management, in your favorite online bookstores, and if you buy a copy and find it useful, I'd love it if you left an honest review. Reviews help readers find interesting books to read, and your help in spreading the word is gratefully appreciated. Thanks so much, and now on to today's episode. I called my mentor into the room because I had a nagging feeling that I might be forgetting or missing something. I was a new nurse, and she had decades of experience. She walked into the room and said my patient didn't look right. We went into a calm flurry, gathering lab values, putting the head of the bed up, collecting fresh vital signs, listening to lung and heart sounds, and paging the doctor. The patient had a new arrhythmia, and we caught it early. We gave her metoprolol, and she responded well. But the question remains, how did that experienced nurse look at a patient and see skipped heartbeats? Is it some sort of special intuition? I asked my mentor how she knew that something was wrong, and she answered, I just knew. Maybe it's some sort of subconscious awareness of the patient's shade to their skin color. Dr. Jake Gunther and Nate Rubin invented a patented technology that uses a camera and software to show subtle changes in skin color with each heartbeat. It's very similar to a pulse oximeter or the heart monitoring on wearable smart technology, which both shine a light on skin and measure the light transmitted through it. However, their system measures the light reflected off skin, otherwise known as visible light. Today, they are selling contactless heart monitors using this technology. But can the human eye catch this kind of subtle difference? The truth is that we don't really know how a medical professional can walk into a room and identify an invisible problem. And yet they do. We know that experience makes a difference. And we know that it saves lives to listen to those experienced clinicians. I would even venture to say that our bedside clinicians are the single best alarm system in the world. An experienced clinician can reliably identify problems before it causes serious harm. Mentors like mine are invaluable to the rest of the team. The challenge is that it is wickedly difficult to put a dollar value on that expertise. The healthcare industry has seen some innovation in the realm of early warnings, trying to provide supporting assessments to help inexperienced staff identify problems in time. One of these tools would be the MUSE and PUSE scores. The Modified Early Warning Score and the Pediatric Early Warning Score both show changes in vital signs. So if an adult's heart rate is normally 60 and they suddenly jump to 90, the MUSE system would alert the nurse even though 90 is still within the normal range, because the change is important to notice and it might not be normal for that patient. But even this system would not alert until routine vital signs are taken. My mentor looked at the patient and said, I should check their vital signs right now, even though they were not due for another 4 hours. There was no history of arrhythmia, and the patient said they felt just fine. The experienced nurse knew what to assess when she felt that nagging suspicion, and she was able to interpret results and communicate them effectively to the physician, because it doesn't help the off-site doctor to call and say, Something seems wrong. Not only do our bedside staff need to recognize that something is off, but they need to be able to uncover the data and communicate it effectively. Later in my career, something made me compare the pulse in a woman's wrist to the central heart rate in her chest. I don't always sit with my stethoscope on someone's chest and check their wrist at the same time, but this time I did. There was a pulsus paradoxus, a difference between the two measurements. Obviously, with one heart in one person, there should be only one heart rate and not two. But the pulse in her wrist and her actual heartbeat were different. This can be a sign of a pericardial effusion and would require an emergency pericardial window. The pressure changes in that condition make it so that the wrist pulse cannot be felt with every beat, and so the rate seems different. This young woman looked perfectly fine, but she needed emergency surgery, and my random suspicion turned into a phone call that led to a life-saving surgery. I still don't know what made me check, but it just made sense at the time. Perhaps it is a miracle. Perhaps my experience at that point led to a subconscious awareness of her situation. But one thing is sure, the suspicions of a bedside clinician are worth their weight in gold. But I've seen similar discoveries from experienced clinicians in the office as well. Remote workers who raised the flag on a major oversight in the budget, or a trend in the electronic chart that indicates skewed data. This is why I'm troubled by the attitude towards staffing in the healthcare world. There is still a prevailing attitude that staff are the most expensive part of healthcare, like an expensive accoutrement, as though their presence was not the only reason patients visit our facilities. Remote healthcare workers are told that they are worth less in pay because they are working at home, even though the company saves money by not providing a physical location and paying for utilities and equipment there. Nurses are working mandatory overtime rather than hiring adequate staff. And all this is in the context of a looming demographic cliff. Did you know that all the baby boomers will have left the workplace by 2034? The generations following our baby boomers have a habit of blaming them for everything that is wrong in the world. I know I have done it. But the hard truth is that by 2034, we are responsible. We know that they are leaving. Did we learn what we needed to learn from them? Did we listen to their advice? Have we gleaned the experience we need from them? Because whatever the world looks like in 2034, it will be our fault then, not theirs. When I think about the legacy I want to leave to my children, I know that valuing human beings is at the top of my list. I want to help others understand how difficult it is to get a dollar value on the contributions of experienced staff. In fact, as a plethora of companies go through layoffs in the upper echelons of skilled healthcare and technology workers, I imagine it's difficult to even know what those experienced employees contributed until they are gone and things stop working. That's why this week's discussion is about the risk of brain drain. When was the last time your team audited human resources for brain drain risk? Has anyone reviewed the need for cross-training? Is there an assessment or a record of employee skills and knowledge, or any type of tracking of subject matter experts? One way or another, the success or failure of healthcare organizations over the next 10 years will depend heavily on their ability to manage the loss of their employees with the most knowledge and experience. But let's break this down first. What is brain drain, and why is it so critical to address in the next 10 years? Brain drain is something that occurs when the system cannot manage the staff that are truly required to deliver a service or manufacture a product. The skilled staff member ends up leaving despite the local need because they need to be paid to survive. So they go to an organization that is ready to use their skills, even if it requires leaving their family and culture behind. In college, I wrote a paper about brain drain in healthcare personnel from developing countries into industrial nations in my comparative politics class. I was surprised to learn that most healthcare workers did not want to leave home. They didn't become a nurse or doctor because they hoped to leave and get rich in America. They wanted to help their own country. And they were frustrated to have to leave behind their family, their culture, and the city where they were born. But when the system could not afford to keep them, they were forced to look elsewhere for work. For example, during the Tigray crisis in Ethiopia, healthcare workers faced the looting of hospitals and the loss of income at facilities that could not afford to keep them, except as volunteers. A British Medical Journal article outlined their goodwill for their nation and their highly qualified skills, education, and experience in a setting where they could not be effective because they lacked basic medical supplies and medications. It's hard to blame them if they had to look for work elsewhere. That's what is typically meant by the term brain drain in most academic circles. But I think there is a place to discuss demographic changes as another type of brain drain. In nations where the aging population is larger than the number of young adults, there is a very tangible problem of asking who will be around to teach the next generation, much less continue all the work we need to continue doing. For example, Japan faced a demographic cliff that resulted in a lower number of workers compared to the need for providers. They even built robots to care for the elderly in nursing homes and created work policies that encouraged parenthood. But as a generation retired and passed away, there were knowledge losses because there were not enough students to learn the skills that older generations were prepared to teach. In your own office, what happens if an employee leaves, retires, dies, or gets laid off? Are there other people who know how to do what they do? How will you know? Is there an organized way to hand off their skills and processes before they leave? Are they making introductions and sharing tribal knowledge before retirement? I have seen this happen over and over, and it's getting more and more difficult to replace qualified people. You might have 18 people working in IT, but if only one of them knows how to generate a Linux instance in AWS, and he or she gets hit by a bus, the rest of them could be in big trouble. Are you at risk of losing the only person who can manage your financial software and upload your client's report? What could happen to your business if that one person had to leave? So many people are enthusiastically embracing the idea that AI could solve all of our staffing problems, but do you know how many skilled developers are required to operate an artificial intelligence program? The crux of the issue is that sometimes what we ask for is not possible. Not everyone can be good at everything, and no matter how many times we wish for it, there is no magic spell that is going to make an employee love the job that we need to fill. Sometimes people just don't want to do the work. Sometimes they struggle to learn what someone else did naturally. There just are not a lot of people available for these specialized roles. Yet I see this mentality a lot, of taking staff for granted as though people are lining up for the job. I have a registered nurse friend who is constantly pulled for overtime, working over 100 hours per week. But there are no open positions on the unit. They are not even trying to hire someone else. Yet they are burning out this highly skilled nurse with critical care experience and a desire to make a difference. Even if you ignore the fact that 60 hours of time and a half pay could easily hire two nurses to alleviate the load, her administration was completely unprepared to deal with the crisis that arose when she recently gave them her notice to leave. Not only are they finding it difficult to hire a replacement to cover the hours, they can't find anyone with the experience they were hoping for. So let me explain what the demographic cliff means for an institution's bottom line. By 2034, the baby boomers will be out of the workforce. The baby boomers make up 25% of the current workforce, and in healthcare, they will make up the majority of the patients we'll be seeing as they enter their elderly years. Fertility rates of the following generations are much lower, so now the healthcare industry is quickly finding itself sandwiched between an increase in demand and a decrease in experienced staff to meet that demand. And in the professional realm, what will we have left when the baby boomers throw their last retirement parties and leave? We need to realize that human beings are valuable, and we need to start acting like it today. This means that if your best employee is getting expensive, the next step is not to kick them out the door to save a buck. It's to look at what it would cost to recruit and train someone to do what they do. It might be a whole lot cheaper to give them their annual raise than to start over with recruitment, training, and upskilling. Unfortunately, a lot of institutions do not even keep track of employee skills. This is a major risk factor. You can't protect something if it's invisible. The first step is to inventory all those skills and abilities and start considering the value of things like experience and reputation. One great way to get this accomplished is to ask employees to document what they are contributing. I often recommend that employees document what they do in great detail, because if they don't, they may not get credit for all the fires they put out. I have often had bosses that said, "I haven't heard anything about you at all. That is really good. You must be doing something right. Usually we get complaints about everyone. That's an odd and backhanded sort of compliment, but it's true. Your best employees and their skills are often unnoticed, and it will take some digging to keep track of them. So ask them how to show their worth. Ask them to write a performance analysis in detail with every committee they are a part of, every project they are involved in, all the software they know how to use, what reports do they create, which areas do they serve as a backup for, and who do they cover for vacation time. Another tip is to watch the overtime rates, even on salaried employees, because it could affect retention. The future of recruitment is incredibly expensive, and retention is worth paying attention to. Overtime and excess paperwork lead to burnout and quitting. And while we're discussing paperwork, I saw a facility that was incredibly successful when they decided to review their documentation requirements. They reduced some of their full nursing assessments on the medical floor to focused assessments. This intervention improved time management and satisfaction for staff who no longer had to work late doing paperwork that they thought was unnecessary. Paperwork and documentation reduction is extremely valuable. Take a look at the GROSS project, which is an acronym for Get Rid of Stupid Stuff, and see if that is something you could initiate at your company for better time management. Another issue that leads to burnout is not making a difference. Healthcare is a high-stress job, and one of the things that reduces stress is the hormone oxytocin. That's why there's such a push for mindfulness in healthcare these days. Meditation can increase oxytocin levels slightly and reduce stress as well as make a person more empathetic and helpful to others. However, do you know what increases oxytocin levels by an even greater amount? Almost 47%? Caring about and helping others. If that's true, healthcare workers should be the most relaxed, happy people on the planet. But they're some of the most stressed. Why is that? I would argue that most of them never get to see the difference they make. HIPAA comes into play here. I have often said that HIPAA should be revised to allow clinicians to see the outcome of their care. We are currently not allowed to check whether a patient discharged or died if we are not the one assigned to care for them on a day of discharge. But it makes such a difference to know if the person you struggled to help survive was able to walk out to their family on the day of discharge. Not knowing whether you've helped or not robs healthcare workers of the joy that should be inherent to their job. Even my friend in accounting focuses on the difference his work makes for his clients, because just doing numbers all day is not satisfying. We need to let our nurses and ancillary staff visit a few patients at the end of their shift each day and see how they are doing. We need to celebrate patient recovery with those who have helped along the way. Meditation and self-focus are woefully inadequate to replace the physiological benefits of doing real good in the world. And our burned-out workforce shows it. Finally, let's make good staffing decisions. A lot of staffing decisions are made blindly, looking only at numbers and salaries. There is a reason why using AI staffing was appealing to Sanford Help, for example, because at least those decisions were based on data trends and not arbitrary decisions from on high. And this is a critical truth. Staffing is not magic. You cannot say the right words and get what you want. It's not a video game where you get a do-over. And your employees don't have multiple lives if you burn them out. On top of that, you then risk finding a new employee who might not get along with the team the way the current employee does. We should stop assuming that people are lining up to do four jobs rolled into one at a discount wage. There are consequences. Treat them right, and they will stay with the company for decades. Sometimes people just don't realize their own talents, weaknesses, and personality enough to appreciate others. When it comes to human resources, a lack of respect for the value of human capital can be a grievous mistake. In 10 years, we will have more demand than supply, and we will be paying higher wages for the inexperienced people we hire. Either we will have a crew of employees that have loyalty to the company from 10 years of growing together, or we will have created a patchwork of low-commitment, high-paid staff who are unsuccessfully trying to multitask several different positions at the same time. But it's not too late. There is still opportunity. Today, I've seen layoffs at several large companies where highly qualified, skilled, experienced workers were left searching for jobs. If I had $1 million, I would gather those healthcare and technology experts to develop all the healthcare solutions we really need. Because these folks are going to be invaluable players in the years to come. They are the skilled innovators who can make things like the demographic cliff go so much easier. If you have room for them now, grab them while you still can, because they will be twice as expensive in another 5 to 10 years. And in the meantime, consider applying some of the solutions in this podcast to get a more accurate inventory of your talent and a better perception of the incredible value gained from the spidey sense that your most experienced staff possess.
Thanks for listening to Quality for the Rest of Us. If you found this episode helpful, please consider liking and subscribing so you'll be notified when future episodes come out. If you have thoughts or questions, you can email qforus@porterqi.com. And if you're interested in joining our community, visit porterqi.com. You'll find podcast archives, helpful articles, innovative tools, and a knowledgeable group of professionals just like you. That's porterqi.com. I hope to see you there.